Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to StrategyPage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of StrategyPage.com, your host. Today we'll be talking to Austin Bay and Al Nofi. Austin Bay is an author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Al Nofi is a military analyst, military historian, and author. Al compiles and writes our popular CIC section on the site. Welcome, Al and Austin. This is our second installment of our discussion on World War I. I thought we could start a discussion today to talk a little bit about the major leaders that were involved at the time. I guess the one that everyone thinks about right off the top, Al, is the Kaiser. Could you tell us a little bit about him?
Well, you know, here's a guy who was quite literally born with a silver spoon. His mother is Queen Victoria's eldest daughter. His father is the emperor's eldest son, and both of them are very well educated. Crown Prince Frederick was a very fine general. I know usually we don't think of these things, but he was an excellent general. He'd proven himself in 1866 and against the Austrians and then against the French. So, you know, the trouble was that, he had several problems, and I don't know where to begin exactly. You could say, to put a sort of a psychological thing on it, that he had very serious emotional problems. He was born because of a botched birth. He was born with a left arm that was noticeably shorter than his right arm. And if you look at pictures of the Kaiser, you'll almost always see the left arm is not clearly visible. Pictures are taken either from his right side, or the left arm is doing something like resting on his sword, or, you know, something like that, so that you never actually see his arm. And he's very self-conscious about this. Oddly, the arm is frequently described as withered, but I once ran across a very curious account. Cornelius Vanderbilt IV, you know, the Vanderbilt family, right? The gazillionaires, was a foreign correspondent during the interwar period. He was born in 1898, and as a child, his family frequently summered with the emperor. Why not, right? On the imperial yacht. And he remembered in his memoirs that one day he was, like any eight-year-old would do or whatnot, you know, he was horsing around on the ship. This is the famous yacht Hohenzollern. And he slipped and started falling overboard. And the Kaiser was nearby, grabbed him with his left hand and hauled him to safety. And that certainly doesn't suggest that the arm was all that dysfunctional. It was just a little shorter, apparently, than the other. But there are people who argue that this caused problems for the Kaiser, you know. Legally, it did disbar the Kaiser from service in the army. You know how it is. But of course, since he was the emperor's grandson and then the emperor's son, that certainly wasn't a problem. And he served. I mean, King Victor Emmanuel of Italy was too short to serve in the army, but nobody noticed when he was, commissioned and so on. You would think that a guy with this great background, I mean, you know, his parents were both 19th century upper-class progressives. Oddly, his father, the old emperor was the victim of an assassination attempt. And he was laid up very seriously injured. And so Prince Frederick became the regent for several months. the only execution ever under either Kaiser Wilhelm I or Prince Frederick when he became Kaiser was the assassin, because Prince Frederick did not believe it was proper for him to, cancel the death sentence of the guy who was trying to kill the emperor. I mean, if the emperor was in good shape and he could do it himself, but he couldn't do it himself. And they had apparently made extensive plans for making some reforms in the empire. The old emperor was relatively neutral on a lot of politics, and Frederick was more progressive. But Wilhelm was different. He was a 12-year-old kid wearing a uniform, standing in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, surrounded by platoons of generals and field marshals and barons and counts and princes and kings, when his grandfather was proclaimed Emperor of Germany. That's pretty heady stuff. So he idolized the old man, and he became emperor much too soon. The old man died in 1888, and when his father inherited, he was already dying of cancer, and he only reigned about 90 days. So Wilhelm became emperor, I guess he was about 24, 25. He'd been tutored a lot, but of course being emperor, they were rather gentle on him. In many ways, very intelligent, well-read, he could quote poetry and stuff. He was a man of his times. He was a racist, but of course that was no big deal in those days. He was an anti-Semite, but his best friend was Albert Behlen, who was Jewish and the head of the Hamburg America line. He disliked his English cousins, but he loved them. He loved England and the Royal Navy and stuff. He was very glib. Unfortunately, his glibness had no breaks. So, give you some examples. 1901, Queen Victoria dies. At the funeral, he tells the British Foreign Secretary that Cousin Nicky, the Tsar, was, quote, only fit to live in a country house and grow turnips. This is not really a diplomatic thing for the Emperor of Germany to say publicly about the Emperor of Russia, you know. It probably was true, but still, not very polite. In 1904, he promised King Leopold of Belgium that in the event of war between France and Germany, he was going to expand Belgium territory, to restore the ancient Burgundian lands. And when Leopold said he didn't think his parliament would go along with that, the Kaiser went bananas on the evils of democracy and giving up your rights as a sovereign and so on. And Leopold was unbelievably upset when he left. And we have to remember that this is the Leopold that was running the Congo Free State. So there weren't a lot of things that would upset him. You can imagine. During the Boer War, now, after the Boer War, well, during the Boer War, he was very pro-Boer, but after the Boer War, he's being interviewed by a British newspaper man a couple of years later, and he says that he personally prevented a Franco-Russian intervention in the war on the side of the Boers, and that he had also drafted the plan that the British used for winning the war and sent it to London, and so on. Not the kind of thing that you would expect a normal sovereign to do. He even spilled the war plans as if it wasn't too obvious. In 1912, after embarrassing himself at the Swiss maneuvers, he was watching the marksmanship contest and asked the winner how many men in Switzerland could shoot that well, and the guy said, about 100,000, Your Majesty. And the Kaiser said, Well, suppose I sent 200,000 men against you, and the guy replied, well, we'll each shoot twice, which didn't go over well. You know, it was a great joke in Switzerland, but didn't go over well in Germany. He turned this supposedly to his advantage by telling the president of Switzerland that with such fine marksmen, he didn't have to worry about the French invading Switzerland, so he would have 6 additional army corps available to invade France. Not helpful. I guess his character can be illustrated in part by a speech he made, public speech in Königsberg, in which he said, I look upon myself as an instrument of the Almighty and go on my way regardless of transient opinions and views. Since he was the head of the church, the German, the Prussian Evangelical Church, he would sometimes, deliver the sermons and stuff like that. And so this was very notorious. When the German army, and I'll leave the anecdotes here, when the German army, when Germany dispatched troops to fight the Boxers, this is what he actually said. He said, when you meet the enemy, you will treat him. You will beat him. You'll give him no pardon and take no prisoners. Those whom you capture are at your mercy. As the Huns 1,000 years ago under King Attila made a name for themselves that has lasted mightily in memory, so may the name German be known in China. That's the origin, of course, of Huns for Germans, which, of course, Germans resent, but unfortunately didn't help very much. Now, he thought himself a military genius. He was almost never out of uniform. I think I occasionally seen him in photographs in civilian clothes, but it's very rare. He even went to the opera in uniform, choosing that of a German gross admiral when he was attending the Flying Dutchman. He had 600 uniforms. There was actually a guy, he had a staff that just took care of his uniforms. He had one for every German regiment, one for every rank he held in everybody's army. He even, had uniforms before some people got their own. Like if a country changed their uniform, he was frequently properly uniformed before the king of that country was uniformed. And he wanted to be glorious. He would attend the maneuvers. He had a multi-room tent made out of asbestos, which he would go on the annual maneuvers, and generally would always win. He liked to charge with end the maneuvers with a grand cavalry charge, 60 squadrons of infantry, of cavalry, thundering down on the enemy as they fled. And just to help out so that his side could win, the defending troops were issued 2 armbands, one in the color of the side they originally were in the war games, and one in the Kaiser's color so that it would look like the infantry was storming up behind them. That was eventually put to an end by Helmut von Moltke, the younger, who took the Kaiser aside and basically said, now, you and I know that you're an excellent soldier, but there are some small-minded people out there who think we're rigging the game in your favor. So it might be better if you just observe the maneuvers. And that put an end to that. The alleged military genius Alfred von Schlieffen had tolerated the Kaiser's antics for 15 years. Says something about, him. One German general, whose name was never recorded, unfortunately, is supported to have said that the Kaiser was unfit to lead 3 soldiers over a ditch. So that was, it could be worse. It could have been 3 soldiers into a whorehouse or something, but, he had a talent for messing things up. Because he thought he was such a genius. When you think about it, when he became emperor in 1888, Germany was allied with or on friendly terms with every country in Europe except France. And by the time, by 1914, so he's only, what, 26 years on the throne? I'm sorry, but 36 years on the throne? Am I counting? No, 26 years on the throne. The only ally he has left is Austria-Hungary, to which he is able to add the Ottoman Empire, which was in even worse shape than Austria-Hungary, and Bulgaria. It just isn't, you know, isn't very helpful. He thought he knew what was happening, which is what prompted him on July 5th to give the Austrians the so-called blank check. He knew the Austrians were delivering an ultimatum to Serbia. He apparently thought it was just going to be this serious dressing down kind of thing, and that would reduce Serbia to some subservience, possibly having to lean on Russia a little bit, so that's why he issued the blank check. And it turned out that, of course, when he gets back, he reads the Serbian reply, and he basically says, my God, you know, they conceded everything. There's no need for war. Well, unfortunately, it was too late, since Austria was already attacking Serbia. He sat down at his desk and signed the mobilization orders. The desk was made of timbers from HMS Victory. So that was one of his problems. To give you an idea of how he continues to go, he never quite grows up, although sometimes he's really smart. 1918, sure, the monarchy is overthrown. He flees to the safety of Holland. He has a motorcade of a dozen cars and 20 railroad cars loaded with his stuff, and he's wearing his full uniform as the supreme warlord of the German Empire, including his sword. And he gets into a tiff with the Dutch border guards because they point out they can't let him in the country armed. You know, sad. He was a moderately good scholar. He was actually into mysticism a bit, and of course archaeology. He was sufficiently smart that when he saw the first demonstration of the Maxim gun in about 1882, I think. About 1892, I think. He said, this is it. We got to get it. And, you know, 1888. I'm sorry. It was demonstrated for the German army in 1888. He saw it demonstrated. I guess Hiram Maxim was probably, you know, firing him. And he said, this is it. You know, we need this. The German army did not acquire Maxim guns until 1899, formally. By then, German officers in some of the colonies were already buying them out of their own pocket because they were so useful in mowing down people, you know. Sad man, he probably would have been great if he just happened to be born in, you know, a British prince instead of not even the heir, just, you know. He would have been well-adjusted and enjoyed tea, that sort of thing. So he was the guy running, owning the most powerful army in the world. What else can you say about him? I don't know.
You've said quite a bit, Al.
So, Austin, who's up next as far as the leaders?
Well, why don't we talk about Great Britain for a second, all right? Okay. I mean, I'm just going to give a sketch. I won't go into the depth of the history that Al did, in part because I can't, but I certainly know the major players. I suppose it's probably best to start with the royalty, since Al was talking about the Kaiser. Let's let's talk about his first cousin, George V, who was also he was a grandson of Queen Victoria. Nicholas II is also his cousin. He suffered from a number of attacks, Dan, he and his family, because they weren't the House of Windsor when the war started, were they, Al?
No, they were the House of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha.
That's right, and which shows, you know, that's goes back to the establishment of the German monarchy in Great Britain. But some of the attacks. I mean, one that I'm aware of is H.G. Wells criticized him. George V was not. He was rather bland person. I guess that's a fair way to describe him. Mm-hmm. And he was an extremely cautious and careful person. He certainly mm-hmm. wasn't charismatic, but Wells had said that he was couldn't inspire people, and he was uninspiring, mm-hmm. and he was also, he called him a foreigner or an alien. I forget. I think it was an alien. Is what he was. And this is one thing where George V actually came back and says, okay, maybe I'm boring. I'm uninspiring, but I am not an alien. I am not a foreigner. And he was quite riled at this. Of course, I mean, there's a war going on. And he's king of England. He's king of the United Kingdom is what he's, you know. So they changed the name to the House of Windsor. And that's, you know, where they're now the House of Windsor. He also, you know, I believe that's the time that he got his cousins, the Battenbergs, to become Mountbattens as
yes.
well. That, I mean, and that's another one. And they they were, the Mountbattens are anything but pro-German. I can assure you about that. But anyway, now I am not an expert in
Just one thing about George.
You want to add something to it?
Yeah.
Okay.
George V was the second son. His older brother died. George V had been earmarked for professional service, career service in the Royal Navy. And until his brother's death, I forget when it occurred, he had been rising. You know, I mean, there was no joke about it. It was very similar to the way, like Prince Charles or now Prince Harry and whatnot, you know, have been serving. They're doing real duty from the bottom up.
Oh, I think he was in torpedo boats at
yeah,
one
torpedo
time.
Boats.
I mean,
he was decorated for rescuing, rescuing
that.
Some folks from drowning.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he was grounded once he became heir. But in one notable instance, shortly after one of the early battle cruisers was commissioned, she made an Atlantic crossing, you know, to impress the Canadians and the Americans and whatnot, and set a speed record. And he took turns. He took his turn shoveling coal. Now he was the heir apparent of, you know, of Great Britain. He was an admiral of the fleet. He had great tattoos, by the way. He was an admiral of the fleet, and he's down there, you know, shoveling coal. So that says, I think, something about the man's character.
Well,
he wasn't inspiring in the normal way, but, you know, neither was Eisenhower.
Look, he was, when I said that he was cautious and careful, I wasn't implying it at all that he, because I am aware of his military record, Al. As a matter of fact, I'm doing this from memory, but I believe Prince Andrew mentioned him as a Well, and this is going to sound ironic, you know, as something of a family inspiration, you know, because Andrew was flying, you know, he was co-pilot flying shaft missions to decoy Argentinian XSA missiles in the Falkland War, and you know, there even the British tabloids kept calling him Randy Andy and all the other stuff. You know, that takes guts.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that, and the perception of the British people, despite the criticisms, and I mentioned H.G. Wells because heck, I'm an H.G. Wells fan, you know, and I'm a but the perception of British people is that this man was a patriot, and I mean they knew what he was doing as a sailor. I was unaware of that story that you just told, though, about the shoveling coal. But what it does say is that he had something to prove. You know, in some shape, form, or fashion, he had something. He had something to prove, and you know, if it means let's change the name of our family, you know, to you know, he's going to do it. And
yep.
is that a big deal? It may not seem that to Americans. We're not royalists, but it's a family steeped in history and pride. I was going to move to the prime minister, and I am not an H.H. Asquith, or Asquith, yes, as the way it's pronounced. I do know there are some things that rather interesting about the fellow. He was supported Irish Home Rule, which was a very divisive subject. He was what? Oh yeah, Dan. Can I go ahead and use Peacenik? On this, comparatively, he was in his own liberal party. He was someone who was trying to find peaceful solutions to the looming conflict in Europe. But when the Germans invaded Belgium, his government had they were ready to go and enforce the Treaty of London, which had committed Great Britain to protect, act on behalf of Belgium's neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
And Great Britain was also part. This is one of the things. Maybe we'll do this in a follow up a podcast. But it would be helpful, I think, Dan, to talk about the alliance structures as well, because Britain and France and Russia were part of the Entente to oppose what the Central Powers. So two first cousins had ganged up on another first cousin. If you look at it from the Victoria's offspring point of view,
that merits a separate discussion, because there's a whole bunch, there's a whole mountain of secrecy on these treaties, and the actual wording of the treaties is frequently not known publicly to high political figures. So we really do need to do that.
One of the things that's I am aware of, and when you bring out that's some of the handshakes, winks, and nods. France and Great Britain had discussed in the first decade of the 20th century how our British Expeditionary Force might cooperate with France. So there were real, honest to God, military planning exercises, or just planning contacts at the highest level. Because where do we insert if there is a war? Where do we insert British ground forces so that they can complement French ground forces in a war against "quote unquote" Central Powers? So,
yeah.
But the thing is,
I want to say though is let's hold that one for next time.
The reason I bring it up is that Esky, whatever his inclinations supports that. Now, I'll just go through a couple of other. You know what? I'll mention three other people I think that are important here. Winston Churchill was Lord of Admiralty in Esky's government. That means he was ultimately in charge of naval support, naval strategy, and the like. Lord Kitchener, actually, I guess he was field marshal at the time. Al can correct me if that's right or wrong, but Kitchener was head of the War Office.
Yeah, he was the first active duty officer to be head of the War Office.
Yeah, and he's there. Who else might we mention? I'll get to Lloyd George in a second, even though he's not at the beginning of the war. John French. Sir John French, who commanded the British Expeditionary Forces. We ought to mention him. Now, Al can flesh this out, but this is one of the things I remember reading in years ago that struck me about French, because he started his military career in the Royal Navy but suffered from seasickness, if I recall. That's correct.
Yes.
But I am not a French fan. The fellow proved even though he had a spotty career in some ways, he fought in Sudan and fought a bitter covering force. Actually, he was a covering force for with the withdrawal after the battle with the dervishes in Sudan. And to pull that off is remarkable. He also fought in the Boer War. Was a major British cavalry leader. So that, in terms of line combat experience, by the time my 1914 comes around, French has proven himself to be a fighter. Now, it doesn't mean he's the right guy for 1914, but that's which is something else that I think Al and I might discuss later in this series. Not to try to plug it, but here's a future show would be to discuss some of the misperceptions, not just simply elan on the part of the French and running into machine guns and the like, but also the finding the right officer for the job. So that's a sketch, Dan, of the Brits. Al, you want me to? Why don't I say something about Raymond Poincaré as well?
Oh yes, yes.
Raymond Poincaré was president of France. He was a strong anti-German. He was typed as being a German hater, and this was something of a he ascribed to the Germans the worst motives. This is often, and I think this is a place where you can look at the leader's personality and see that with the levels of suspicion that Poincaré brings to the office, distrust for the Germans, dislike for the Germans, certainly adds to the temperature, the rapidly rising temperature after the murder of the Archduke. Poincaré was not an incompetent politician, but that is he certainly had to call it a grudge doesn't do justice to it. The man hated the German government, distrusted the Germans, and that certainly shaped his perceptions of events June and July 1914.
Yeah, the
I'm guessing, on that.
One of the other things, though, is there were some efforts by some Germans and some French to reach beyond certain issues. And Poincaré had actually been invited to a dinner at the German embassy in Paris and attended in early January 1914, I think, as part of this outreach, which was like an unbelievably radical thing. Now that could be because he was trying to, you know, cover his flank on the peace freak side, so to speak, the accommodation side, because his great political rival was Callot, who had been prime minister several times and arguably would become prime minister again, and he was his rival for president too. Now that's going to play in later, because shortly before the assassination, Kylo's wife murders the newspaper guy for revealing love letters between the two that were pretty, I mean, I've read some of them and they're pretty impressive, you know. 1,000 kisses on your little body, you know. but these love letters were exchanged before they were married. While they were both married to other persons. So it's a great scandal. Anyway, that's one of those things, you know, how did the shooting come about, which we need to devote, I think, some time to. But Poincaré was one of these people, didn't want a war. But if one came along, he wasn't going to back down. And I think that's critical to a lot of the politicians in France. You know, in Germany, there were some who really wanted a war. Some of the government leadership certainly thought a war was necessary. If we shift from France to Austria, we can name a particularly important government leader, the chief of the general staff, Konrad von Holzendorf, who literally, you know, was like every other month for years, was trying to get the Kaiser to go to war with somebody, usually Serbia, but occasionally Italy. For a variety of reasons, you know, you have a declining empire, and it's worried about its image. It's worried that people are taking them for granted. It's worried that people are going to see them as weak. Events in the Balkans have not turned out quite to their satisfaction. Holzendorf really wants to go to war. And he's another guy who's got psychological issues. His father, Holzendorf was born when his father was quite an old man. His father had been the commander of the cavalry escort when Napoleon went to Elba, the Austrian army cavalry troops that accompanied Napoleon to Elba were commanded by this guy's father. And, you know, nearly 40 years later, Konrad is born, so his father had to be in his pushing 70 by now, you know. So I suspect that might have something to do with it. And he's dealing with a very complex military situation, and he thinks he's a genius. He's absolutely in love. He writes his girlfriend every day, despite the fact that she's married and has six kids. He thinks the Germans are the enemy, as well as the Serbs and the Russians, and so, you know, a bit of a problem there. He's on good terms with the Kaiser, Franz Josef. And Franz Josef is usually looked upon as this kindly figure. He certainly has a tragic life. His brother is shot in Mexico. His brother's wife goes nuts. His other brother is a religious fanatic and actually sends an expedition to the Holy Land to bring him back water from the Jordan River, and he promptly catches some disease and dies. His son blows his brains out because nobody liked his girlfriend, I guess. You know, the son is usually depicted as this reformer. I don't know if you you saw the movie with Omar Sharif playing the Archduke Rudolph, and he's depicted as some sort of a reformer. I'm not sure that he is. His problem was that his father was an emotional iceberg. Franz Josef's wife, Franz Josef had several children, but only one son. Franz Josef's wife she was the Wittelsbach, and the Wittelsbach royal family was like this laid back middle class bunch of folks. You know, they go for picnics in the country and go skinny dipping and stuff like that. And Franz Josef was brought up unbelievably rigid. When Rudolf came back from a tour to the provinces one time, he came up to his father and hugged him, and his father called him to attention and told him to make his report. I mean, you know, little much. Franz Josef gave the Empress a dose, whereupon she basically broke relations with him permanently. Although she did arrange for him to have a nice young girlfriend that stayed with him for the next 40 years. And Rudolf gave his wife a dose, and then he had his girlfriend and blew his brains out because his wife didn't like his girlfriend, which is about the only thing I can understand about it, you know, after murdering his wife. So now it devolves on Franz Josef, Franz Ferdinand, and Franz Ferdinand gets murdered. So we tend to look at Franz Josef as this tragic figure. His problem was that he was like, he had to be forced to do anything.
Well, he did issue the ultimatum to Serbia.
Yeah,
I mean he did that.
But that was because of the image thing. In other words, he was stuck in another, you know, this great empire not in decline. From the heady days of the fall of Napoleon, Austria has been slowly declining, and they even had to make an arrangement with the Hungarians to turn it into a dual monarchy, which must have really, you know, been bitter. He accepted that there would have to be war with Serbia.
Dan, I'm taking a look at the time here, and let me use this as a segue. What Al just said about declining empires, to touch on two other major empires.
Yes,
the Romanov Empire, the Russian Empire. We've talked about Tsar Nicholas II a little bit. That's an empire that is several failed attempts at modernization, and then the Ottoman Empire, where it's Mehmet V, and I might spend some more time in another show, but talking about the decline of the Ottoman Empire, and it's a 300-year decline. Of course, we talked a little bit about this in a previous program, where I talked about the Ottoman decay, particularly in the Balkans, but also in North Africa. Mehmet V oversees this. His secret police are constantly harassing modernizers within the military and within the civil service. They're there. I tell a story in the story. It's the absolute fact of the arrest of Mustafa Kemal when he's in school in Istanbul, and he gets out, but it's because he was perceived as a potential political threat, because he was such an advocate of educational and social modernization. It's funny that some of the Ottoman Empire is maybe not funny at all when you compare it to similar situations. Biggest advocates for modernization were some of their best military leaders. So the Sultan had to make a choice: do I want crack officers, or do I want politically correct officers? And you need a few crack officers. Politically correct are going to lose if there's a war. But there's a Sultan Mehmet V is more concerned about his dynasty, Dan, than he is about anything else. So there's I think that's a, you know, Al, let me come back and say one more thing about Raymond Poincaré. Al's pronunciation is, of course, the correct French.
No, I don't know what French is.
Right, but I use the anglicization. I mean, that's the, you know, the point. But when I said he was anti-German, Al came back and see that there's some post-World War I, after the Bolsheviks take over in Russia, propaganda that tries to blame Poincaré for starting World War One. And it is, Al, is it fair to say it's a crock? It is a crock.
Yeah, you know.
But it's in part because Poincaré had made a couple of trips to Russia. He was very interested in securing assurances from Great Britain and Russia that if there was a war, the Entente partners, allies would fight. And if Al, correct me if I'm wrong on this. I'm pretty sure Poincaré was family was from Lorraine, wasn't it?
I believe so. Yeah.
All right, but you know if I'm wrong, our listeners will jump all over me. But the point being, they're then one of the contested territory between France and Germany. But the thing is that when I say he was anti-German and suspicious of the Germans, I'm not saying that he was an advocate for war. But when it begins to boil, he's ready to move.
Yeah.
All right.
One of the things, the claim that it was Poincaré and the Tsar of all people. You know?
Oh yeah. Well, that's
he comes. One of the things that happens here is on the reason the Austrians took so long to issue their ultimatum. If you think about it. Because the assassination is on the 28th of June, they decide to issue an ultimatum about 5 days, 6 days later. They don't actually issue it until 3 weeks later. The reason is that Poincaré and his prime minister go to Russia on a state visit. The French want, the Austrians want to issue the ultimatum while he's at sea returning from Russia. So they can't really coordinate, you know, their war plan. So, yes, it's true that he spends several days in Russia. And, of course, this is a state visit. It's the 19th century. You're delivering toasts to your allies and whatnot, right? I mean, we'd be embarrassed if someone did these things today, but it was common in those days. You know, you'd bring a toast to the Tsar, and then you drink a toast to the Russian people, and then you drink a toast to the glorious Russian army, and so on, right? So people
that still goes on in its own way today.
Yeah. But in those days, of course, you did it in the midst of this pomp and military ceremony.
Sure.
And you have military reviews. I mean, let's face it, we don't have military reviews anymore, right?
No, not like that. No. But my point is that we do have our, especially when there are crises, and then you see committed allies come together. But it does not have the display that the nobility demanded. You know, we have the internet and television, you know, now, and reality shows to thrill the people.
I think part of the problem of the argument about who started the war is because they inserted the war guilt clause. Everybody was guilty, you know. They all had been doing stuff that raised or lowered the, you know, or changed the tension and over the years. If you want to find a better term, would be who's responsible. You know, it's as if we were living in, you know, you're living in a house and you're throwing rags in a closet. Well, if everybody's throwing rags in the closet, they're all equally guilty when the rags finally cause a fire. Somebody may be responsible for dropping the match. And there we have to go heavily to the Austrians and the Germans. The Austrians acted totally without any sense of the implications of their actions. I mean, they really believed that there would be no war. And the Kaiser seconded them because he also believed that there would be no war. But both of them were willing to have a war if it happened. Now, this was different from previous crises in many ways, where issues, you know, where interests butted up against each other and each side, you know, didn't want to back down and the possibility of war was there, but nobody wanted a war. 1914, the Austrians certainly wanted a war and the Germans said, okay.
Well, like, this is probably a good place to finish this discussion with saying the Austrians wanted a war. Al, the Austrians wanted to be able to stop Serbian directed resistance in Bosnia, and if that meant smashing the Serbs, so be it. I think that's a way to. Mm-hmm. You said anyway. That's the way I would frame that prior to the assassination.
Yeah.
Of the Archduke. You see what I'm saying on that?
Yeah, and I think one of the important things here is.
We're getting into those Balkan things that I've written about.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's the can of worms that's still right. Writhing. One of the things that's interesting is Serbia had been somewhat of an Austrian client state. It sort of hit the fan when the Austrians annexed Bosnia-Herzegovina, which they had been administering in the name of the Sultan for 30 years, which the Serbs didn't like, but it was better than having the Sultan running the place. Because remember, the Russians, who wanted to be patrons of the Serbs, were also patrons of the Bulgarians. And if there was anybody the Serbs hated more than the Austrians, it was the Bulgarians. But once Austria annexes Bosnia, it turns the Serbs more towards Russia.
Well, this also gets into our first discussion where we talked about the Turco-Italian war of 1911, 1912, and then subsequent first and second Balkan Wars, the three series, the little wars that lead set us up for the big explosion of June and July and early August 1914. I'm just again looking at the time here. I think we've Al. You know one other thing.
Can I give you one more anecdote?
Oh yeah. Can I toss out one though? Because you brought up all the womanizing. I think Asquith was also known as a philanderer.
Oh yes.
Yes. Okay. So we've got a lot of that running. I just had to toss that out for the soap opera people. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
In fact, I think the Kaiser was the only person I can think of. Of the prominent folks who didn't have at least one girlfriend. I can't recall any suspicion of the Kaiser. When George V decided to change the name of the royal family from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor, the Kaiser remarked something like, "We'll have to change the title of Shakespeare's plays to The Merry Wives of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha." So he was a good witticism, you know. Unfortunately, the guy's smarts didn't extend to deeper, more profound kind of stuff, you know. And we didn't get a chance to talk about the Tsar, but
we'll get to Russia.
We'll pick up the Tsar. Hopefully, next time we'll be getting up to August of 1914 and getting ready to just. Prior to kicking things off.
Cavrillo's greatest hit.
Right. So we will talk to you all next time.
Take care, guys.
Have a great day.
Bye.